This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Natalia Melman Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2. And of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Arseny Sokolov, and the podcast you're about to hear was quite a challenge to make. I had to call up a lot of bereaved people in Russia, people I didn't know at all, women whose husbands and sons were killed in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And after expressing condolences, I had to ask them about something else that in most cases they understandably didn't really want to talk about. Whether they're better off financially after their loss. An intrusion into their privacy, but an important and surprising story that tells you a lot about Russia today. This is Assignment, Russia's new war elite.
You better move that hand away from the mic. Ready? We are recording.
Last spring, the Russian army attacked the village of Semenivka in the east of Ukraine.
We are all that's left here under the rubble.
From a basement, soldiers record a goodbye message to their loved ones. The marks of a furious battle are etched on their dirt-covered faces. Their eyes are glassy and empty. Three of them alive and one dead, on whom they've rested their legs. Far away, in a small town in Bashkortostan, in the Ural Mountains of central Russia, Ksenia waited for news of another soldier fighting in the same battle, her husband, Artem.
I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. We lived next to a forest, and all I could do was stare out of the window. And there was a flock of swans flying past, so beautiful. But straight away, I thought it was a sign.
Her foreboding was justified.
On June the 3rd, his body came back. The funeral was with full honors, a military salute, a speech by the local administration. Even the bishop came from another town and carried the coffin on his shoulders.
But Putin's Russia doesn't just honor its fallen with empty words. It provides material comfort for their families too.
The one-off payment came, then the payment from the regional government, and soon after that, Putin's payment. We're still waiting for the insurance payments and for the Ministry of Defense pension for loss of a provider.
Together, that's a lot of money. Welcome to Assignment on the BBC World Service. I'm Arseny Sokolov, and in this program, I'm finding out how the massive payouts for serving soldiers and bereaved families are changing lives. And asking whether the money will help create a new patriotic middle class, a war elite, as Vladimir Putin hopes.
Из чего же сделаны наши мужчины? Из татушек и проколотых ушек.
What are our men made of? Tattoos and pierced ears? The recruiting advert asks.
Присоединяйся к тем, кто сделан из чести.
What are you made of? Since 2023, Russia's war effort in Ukraine has relied primarily on volunteers. But in case patriotism isn't enough of a motivation, there are inducements. Regions compete over who can send more men to the war. Some offer 2 million rubles to those signing up. That's $20,000. The result? As reported by the Russian Defense Ministry, more than 100,000 men signed up in the first 3 months of last year alone. That's up to 1,700 every day. One was Ksenia's husband, Artem Baranov. This is the sound of him plunging into icy water to celebrate the Feast of Epiphany, as religious Russians do every January. Artem was an earnest, confident man with a black beard, deputy head of the local power station. Deeply patriotic, his heroes were Stalin and Putin. He was also a beekeeper. And in one of his apiculture videos, alongside remarks on destructive gay culture, he praised the tiny creatures for their collectivism and readiness for self-sacrifice.
Это великое самопожертвование.
A bee will give its life without hesitation for the common good, he said, even if its life lasts only a month. Artem signed up at the end of February 2024. He was killed in Ukraine just a month later. Ksenia was overwhelmed with grief. She wrote a book about Artem and their happy life with their three young children, calling it Memory of the Heart. And she used a little of what Russians call the coffin money to publish a few copies, but most of the cash was still left. There was the one-off federal payment, 5 million rubles, or $50,000. Putin's presidential payment, another 5 million. The insurance payment, 3.5 million, or $35,000. And the regional payment, in Bashkortostan, that's 2 million. So altogether, Ksenia got 15 million rubles. That's $130,000.
How did I use the money? First of all, I renovated the house to take my mind off things. I started to turn my life around. I threw out everything old. And I'm planning to buy the children a flat, as a hedge against inflation, to invest the compensation in property.
In rural Bashkortostan, she will be able to afford a very substantial flat. And bereaved families all over Russia are turning their lives around. Economist Vladislav Inozemtsev calls it deathonomics.
If someone signs up to the army at the age of 35 from not the most wealthy Russian regions, gets the regional payment for the signature of the contract, serves there 6 to 8 months and is killed, and all the compensations are paid to his family, it would be definitely bigger sum of money than he could earn till the end of his active life at the age of 65.
Money that, despite the grief, enables people to fulfill their dreams.
He's a qualified chef, and from when he was 15, he used to help me as a waiter in the restaurant where I worked.
This is Oksana Nazarenko, herself a cook, telling about her son Andrei.
So, I suppose he liked that kind of work, and he went on dreaming about it when he joined the special military operation. He used to say, "Mom, when I get back, let's open a cafe together. You'll be the cook, and I'll be the waiter. It'll be great."
But Andrei didn't come back. He died fighting in Ukraine, age 21. Оксана attended the ceremony at his old school in a small town in the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains of southern Russia, where they solemnly unveiled a desk adorned with portraits of Andrei and excerpts from his life story. And then,
when all those payments came, I decided, well, if that's what he wanted, if that was his dream, I'll use the money to open a restaurant.
And she has. It's a cozy little place, seating about 50.
We do lots of different cuisines, European, Caucasian, a bit of Japanese, like sushi. And my signature dish? Well, I do lagman.
a rich noodle dish with meat, vegetables and spices.
People go crazy about it. They all say, wow, that's some lagman. And every night when I go to bed, I talk to Andrei. I say, I opened the restaurant just like you wanted. And if you were still here, I know you'd be helping me.
The business has been so successful, she's now thinking of adding a little coffee shop at the side. But first, she needs to win a court battle with Andrei's father, her ex-husband. The couple separated when their son was just 2.5.
Then Andrei and I lived with my parents till Andrei was 7. During that time, his father used to visit him a few times a year. He brought sweets, but he didn't even buy those himself. He got them from his parents. Once he took him to the seaside, though it was without my consent. And that's all. After that, we moved. And his father stopped seeing him at all. At all.
Andrei's father didn't come to his funeral either. He was too busy collecting documents to apply for compensation for his son's death. The Russian media has highlighted ever more cases like that, of greedy, absent fathers who crawl out of the woodwork in expectation of money when their sons die. Oksana and other bereaved single mothers battling to keep all the payouts for themselves are supported by a group formed by Anastasia Yudina. She had the same problem after her son was killed.
The world's gone mad, as though someone's life can be swapped for money. All those biological fathers, their eyes light up. They imagine themselves buying new flats, new cars. They try to solve their financial problems at the cost of a dead son, of our children's heroism.
In a Russia hit by sanctions and inflation, it's extremely difficult to match the salary of those fighting Putin's war. So a man in uniform can easily become a target of gold diggers. A man perhaps like Vitaly Pshenichny. He was killed on his 47th birthday in the same battle for Semenivka as the beekeeper Artem Baranov. Vitaly's sister, Ekaterina Kosygina, from Tyumen in western Siberia, says he had signed up to earn some money for his teenage son. Vitaly wasn't married, she says, so after his death, his family expected they would get the payout on behalf of the boy. But then...
2 months after he died, a woman phoned up. She asked why she couldn't get through to Vitaly. Well, I said he was killed. Killed? That's impossible. Where was he killed? When? And then she said, we were planning to get married. Planning! That's the phrase I remember. We were planning to get married. And then, a week later, a lawyer for this woman turns up at the army office and says, I represent Vitaly's wife. They were married officially, and we claim all the money.
Soon, millions of Russians were following this story on a popular TV show.
2 months after a man's funeral, his unknown widow suddenly turns up and grabs all his millions for herself. The grief-stricken relatives are convinced she's a swindler because the dead man was never married.
What emerges is that the mysterious bride, called Victoria, just happened to be a nurse at the military hospital where Vitaly was treated after being injured in Ukraine. But his sister Ekaterina tells me he was a lifelong bachelor. He never even married the mother of his son. So why did he suddenly jump into wedlock with Victoria, a woman less than half his age, whom he had known for only a couple of weeks?
I think she set out to marry him just because there was a big chance he'd never come back.
The chance was high indeed. And maybe that explains the demand for soldiers on Russian dating apps and groups. Researching this program, we came across hundreds of ads in which lonely women are looking for participants of the so-called special military operation. But whatever Victoria's motives were, Vitaly's sister Ekaterina is determined that she shouldn't get the money. It should all go to Vitaly's son, her nephew.
He dreamt of having a house. I think if everything works out, he'll buy himself a big house, maybe with some land. He doesn't want to live in a flat. He's dreaming of a house.
But the bride, Victoria, has other ideas. This is what she says when I manage to track her down.
I am his wife. That's official. I don't quite get you. What am I supposed to give up?
The compensation?
Well, who says no to money? What a weird idea. Vitaly wanted to look after me. We were planning to have children together. Vitaly is my husband. Why should I give up what I am entitled to?
And on the show, Victoria dramatically turns the table on her late husband's family. They are the money grabbers, not her, she claims. They've never taken any interest in Vitaly's son till now. They left him to be brought up by other foster parents. Indeed, he may not be Vitaly's son at all. The show, reveling in this sensational twist, commissions a DNA test. And the boy, now 17, learns on live TV that he is probably not Vitaly's son. Екатерина is beside herself with fury as her family's chances of getting the 15 million rapidly disappear. The boy himself is silent, his face blank. But she's taking the case to court. This is a documentary from the BBC World Service.
Hi, I'm Namulanta Kombo, here to tell you that my podcast, Dear Daughter, is back. And this time, I'm joined by an all-star lineup of guests, each with some sage life advice and a letter for their daughter.
Every mother has a letter in her head for their daughter. So it's really nice that that's being like expressed out loud.
That's Dear Daughter stars from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.
You're listening to Assignment with me, Arseniy Sokolov. Compensation, salaries, signing up bonuses. To many Russians, it sounds like a fair price for joining the invasion of Ukraine. Of course, you may lose your life. But as they used to say in the Soviet Union, the motherland will not forget its heroes.
We can definitely talk about an emergence of a new middle class in Russia, in provincial cities and towns. It is mostly driven by the Kremlin's spending on the war.
Says financial analyst Alexander Kalyander, that new class is buying cars, flats, and...
A hairdresser told me this story.
This is a journalist, I'll call her Yulia to protect her identity, from the remote region of Buryatia in the east of Siberia.
She said she's now always getting requests from soldiers' wives for a masterclass in using a Dyson hairdryer. You know, there's this cult of Dyson among influencers on social media. So a man has to give his wife or girlfriend a Dyson.
Despite sanctions, they're still imported into Russia by third countries.
A hairdryer for $450? Man, that sure is a lot.
They're way overpriced, and all these military wives want to know how exactly to coil their hair with them. Perhaps it shows that women are living a bit better now that their menfolk are earning money in the war.
Earning and suffering. This Buryat singer is performing to cheer up wounded compatriots undergoing treatment in a frontline hospital. Buryatia is one of the regions with the highest number of men serving and dying. It's also one of the poorest regions, with few good jobs. Before, people would go off to South Korea for work. Now, they're going to Ukraine, this time with guns in their hands.
One young man told me about a friend who was killed in the war. He said dying was the only good thing that that friend had ever done for his family. He was an alcoholic. He got on badly with his wife and children. Then he went off to fight. And after 2 or 3 months, he was dead. And the family not only lived peacefully after that, they also got the payout.
And in Buryatia, where property is perhaps 5 times cheaper than in Moscow, those payments go a long way.
You could buy a whole village on the proceeds from one man's death.
Buryat lawyer and human rights defender Nadezhda Nizovkina. But she says the newly acquired blood money isn't always very visible. New cars, perhaps, but fancy new houses, usually not.
Many people now are scared to flaunt their wealth, because showing you got rich on spilled blood, it means you or your relative didn't sign up out of high moral principles. The big recruiting posters don't mention money. They just say stand up and defend the motherland as a selfless gesture.
The Kremlin is determined that those who return alive from the front line will be treated as heroes.
Военнослужащие по контракту получают региональные меры поддержки.
This advert lists the privileges offered to veterans and their families, from land tax exemptions to free holidays in resorts. And there are opportunities to better themselves socially. Children of soldiers, alive or dead, can go to university whatever their grades. Regional governments offer soldiers business training and low-percent loans for startups. Russian media reports on battle-hardened businessmen making furniture, opening rabbit farms, opening coffee shops, even a planetarium. But strangely, I had great difficulty tracking down any of these newly made entrepreneurs. Maybe it's an attempt to create a picture that men coming back from war are not traumatized and broken, but enthusiastic and full of opportunities. Or maybe it's just too early to know whether the returning soldiers can really better themselves. But in any case, Vladimir Putin also has an even more ambitious scheme for social engineering. Those who survive will form a new patriotic elite in business and politics to replace the existing liberal, anti-war middle class, which he claims to despise. The real elite, he says, are those who serve Russia, loyal workers and warriors whose actions prove devotion to Russia. And a government program called Time of Heroes will fast-track selected veterans into leadership positions in local administration and businesses. But Yulia, the journalist from Buryatia, says she's not seen many examples in her region.
The only person in Buryatia from this so-called new elite, for a long time, he was the mayor's assistant in Ulan-Ude. He was like an errand boy, always running back and forth, making sure his boss's car arrived on time and so on. Then he went off to fight. And when he came back, he became a city councillor. But he was already one of them. He'd served the authorities all his life. But the idea that, let's say, an ordinary village lad, a tractor driver, could go off to the war, come back, and become even a village councillor, I've never heard of that. Basically, the elite is the elite. They don't let any outsiders in.
For now, it's not so much making them an elite as about using them into brainwashing efforts.
Economist Vladislav Anaziemtsev.
Very often, these people are paid for going to schools to talk to the pupils, to the students, about how they fought in this war, the lessons of patriotism. But I don't believe that the bureaucracy, which actually ripened in Russia for these 25 years, will easily give up and open the doors for these people to infiltrate into its ranks.
And what about bereaved families? By the end of January, the BBC and independent Russian outlet Mediazona had identified by name more than 90,000 Russian soldiers killed in Ukraine. They believe the actual number may be at least 150,000. If each of their families had actually received full compensation, and the average is 14 million rubles, that would mean the state has spent more than 2 trillion rubles on it over the last 3 years. That would be equivalent to more than 2% of federal government spending in that period. But did it create a new middle class?
The middle class is not created by the amount of money someone has. Middle class is created by engaging in some kind of productive work. The principle of these death payments is a kind of a lottery. You win, you get your $200,000, your husband is dead, you are still a housewife, you don't have a lot of needed qualifications for further life.
Vladislav Inozemtsev compares the war in Ukraine with another that the Soviet Union fought two generations ago.
The Russians, they have a very good remembrance about what happened to the veterans of the Afghanistan war.
Its veterans, too, were idolized in Kremlin propaganda. But they became best known as a lost generation. Their melancholy guitar ballads suffused with bitterness. Many took to drugs or got involved in violence. They were hardly an elite. Will it be the same for veterans of Putin's special military operation?
How will they integrate back into the society? Many people returning, wounded, they are trying to spend their money as soon as possible. They are very inclined to violence. There are a lot of cases when people, especially women, are killed or raped by these people. Even the government confirms that violent crimes are on the 15-year high.
The Afghan veterans were conscripts or professional soldiers. Veterans of the Ukraine war, by contrast, are mostly volunteers. The money they and their families are paid may buy their loyalty and gratitude to the state. Whether or not those payouts produce major social change will only become clear when survivors of the trenches return home and the cash start to circulate more freely. But what strikes me is the fundamental contradiction in the Kremlin strategy for maintaining a steady flow of volunteers. On the one hand, it portrays them as heroes. On the other, it's forced to appeal to their most mercenary instincts. Anastasia Yudina, who campaigns for bereaved single mothers like herself to get all the coffin money, believes her son Kemal died fighting a just war in Ukraine. She's proud of the bravery medal he was posthumously awarded. And yet, she too sees the contradiction. The state she supports has itself shown exactly how expendable its heroes are.
Everyone thinks those millions they pay out are a fair price for the death of their son. So that's the value that someone, somewhere, has placed on our children's lives.
Thanks for listening. Russia's New War Elite was presented by me, Arseniy Sokolov, and produced by Tim Hewell. Sound mixing was by Neil Churchill, the production coordinator was Gemma Ashman, and the editor, Penny Murphy.
Hi, I'm Namulanta Kombo, here to tell you that my podcast, Dear Daughter, is back. And this time, I'm joined by an all-star lineup of guests, each with some sage life advice and a letter for their daughter.
Every mother has a letter in her head for their daughter. So it's really nice that that's being like expressed out loud.
That's Dear Daughter Stars from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.